From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Our program topic this week is AIDS, and this is part two. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2014 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host. I'm really glad you guys can join us today on what I think is going to be one of the more important topics we've done in our entire time we've been on the air. If you'd like to listen to the longer version of any of our programs, actually, you can catch them at KUAR.org. Just click on the Programs button there, and you'll slide all the way down to the last page where Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is. You'll find the longer versions and the shorter versions of our programs there. We're going to be talking about AIDS today. You may be asking yourself, why in 14 years have we not talked about AIDS? Well, I think there's a real important reason why I've chosen not to talk about it till now, and that is that our generations, if you're a young person or a middle-aged person or an older person, you go through roughly 20, 25 years of time before you jump into that next category. And when you think about AIDS and our awareness of AIDS, going back to roughly 1980 or so, and you put the segments of generations, we're really just at the point now where everybody has jumped a category. Our younger people are just now jumping in. Our middle-aged people were young. They're in the middle age now. Our older people were in the middle age, and now they're jumping into the older age. We have some perspective now to look at this from a generational perspective, and that's what we want to talk about today. I do want to share with you my guests that are all three in the studio here today. Speaking from the younger generation is Dr. Keir Vyas, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases here at UMS. Dr. Vyas, thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much.
And then speaking from the middle generation is Dr. Michael Cicente, Professor of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases here at UAMS. Dr. Cicente, glad to have you here.
Happy to be here.
And then speaking from the older generation perspective is John Allen, a consultant for HIV and AIDS in the Division of Infectious Disease, also here at UAMS. John Allen, thanks for being with us here today.
Glad to be here.
Did the word cure come into the mindset of people in those early years?
Searching for the cure, yes, and searching for the answer, but certainly what we saw were a lot of patients dying. So that's not as much as we think about it now. We don't have any medications right now that we can give in combination that cure people. But there is hope for a cure in a sense with HIV, and that's another way that we use the medication, and that is to control transmission of the virus to other people. Because studies show that people that are on HIV medications, if they have an undetectable viral load, it's extremely unlikely, especially with condom use, that they would give the virus to their partner. So the hope is that as we get more and more people on effective therapy, get their viral load down, that we'll see very few new infections.
What about the word cure for you, Dr. Cicente?
In my early days as a physician who treated HIV, cure did not enter our vocabulary. I was more inclined to say to a patient, if we can just keep you alive until the next new drug comes out. New drugs from new classes were added to what we already had. And for patients that were not doing well, that were failing their current therapy, we didn't have a lot of backups. And so we would say, you know, I know that there's a new class coming out and a non-NUC reverse transcriptase inhibitor, and they work really well. The science is behind it. If you can just hang in there until we have that, and then we could have some backup plans. And then I transitioned through the what Dr. Vyas was alluding to about pill burden and going from 18 pills a day or 24 pills a day down to 6 a day, down to 1 a day with combinations and new classes of drugs coming out. I'll let Dr. Vyas talk more about cure. So most of my career has been spent telling patients that we can control this virus like we can control diabetes or high blood pressure. You know, let's diagnose it. Let's get you on treatment. Take your medicines. You can expect to live, for many patients, essentially a normal lifespan. But we can't cure you, which means you could still infect somebody else. Again, the likelihood is very low. Unlike diabetes, you can still transmit HIV, although the risk is very low if you're on therapy. So again, most of my career was not thinking about cure as much as it was controlling everybody, reducing transmission, keeping folks alive like we would somebody with any chronic medical condition. Cure will require a somewhat of a different approach than what we've been using. So the current medicines that we have in our armamentarium, the protease inhibitors, the nucleosides, the non-nucleosides, the integrase inhibitors, there are a couple other new classes that are out there. We don't think any of that by itself is going to cure anybody. When the researchers look real hard for residual virus in protected sites like lymph nodes, they find it even in people who have had completely suppressed viral loads for decades and decades. So a cure will have to combine that approach with some other novel approach.
Well, Dr. Vias, let me ask that question to you in a slightly different way. Does the younger generation expect a cure?
I don't know about expect, but they are certainly hearing more about the possibility. And so I get asked that question, as I'm sure my partners do, not infrequently, because what we're hearing, there have been cases of patients that have received novel treatments, certainly things that are high risk and would not be appropriate for the vast majority of patients, and they seem not to have the virus. Now, there is an emerging concept of the difference between what's called a sterilizing cure, or what we would typically think of, we treat you and now you no longer have this disease. And that's one goal at this point, out of reach, at least for the foreseeable future. But there's another thought of something called the functional cure, that perhaps you still have the virus, but your own immune system is able to control it. And so you don't have to be on medicines. Maybe we have to, keep an eye on you. You have to visit your doctor. And that seems to be an area that's very promising. But again, it's going to take a lot of more research and a lot of thinking outside of our current medications. But the possibilities are there. And we're learning more and more from various studies that have come out in various parts of the world, where there are people that were treated very, very early after their infection. So, within the first few weeks of becoming infected, they were treated with very highly effective therapy. And then when they came off of therapy, they did not see a rebound of the virus. Or if they were able to detect the virus, it was at very, very low levels, as if they were on therapy, but without being on any medications. The most recent story like that is out of Mississippi, a baby that was born to a mother who was infected with HIV. And the child was started very quickly on a combination of medications and was on them for about a year, and then was lost to follow-up for a while. When the baby returned to care, the virus was not detectable. They can still find a little evidence of the virus, but not to the degree that what would be expected for somebody who's been off of therapy. So there are some interesting things on the horizon. Our patients, as many patients tend to be, they read the news and they're looking at this, and so they're asking, and they do see that there's a lot of research being done in that direction. What I tell them from everything that we see, it's going to be several years away, if at all. But in the meantime, we've got such great options, and our patients now, especially when, if we can test them early, identify them before they develop AIDS, before their immune system is affected, if we can identify people early, they never have to develop AIDS. They never have to have a complication of HIV. They can live to be a normal lifespan. In the best case scenario, one pill once a day, that's a lot better than many other diseases that people have to try and live with. So.
Well, let's bring the AIDS discussion back here into Arkansas. What is the situation with AIDS in Arkansas, and even from a generational standpoint? John Allen, what do you see as AIDS in Arkansas?
Well, total, we've had about 8,000 cases altogether, and about 5,000 of those 8,000 cases are people that have developed AIDS. I think we have about 2,500 deaths to date. Is the epidemic among children. It used to be in the late 80s and very early 90s that we saw a lot of cases that where the virus was transmitted from mother to child. The first drug that we used to prevent that was AZT, and with that one drug alone, the cases would go from about 25 to 30% down to 10% rate of transmission. And then we really saw the number of HIV cases among children in the early 90s go way down. And then another drop in the number of HIV and AIDS cases among children happened around 96 when we had triple drug therapy, and that's now the standard of care for women who are pregnant to get those drugs. And with that, we see very few, if any, cases in Arkansas of transmission from mother to baby. So that's a big, big success that we have.
Dr. Sassenti?
Many of those women would not be tested were it not for the fact that they were pregnant. So there's been a state law on the books now for a very long time that mandates testing for HIV. I think that's a perfect illustration of what we can do when we test people, diagnose them. In this case, we're talking specifically about pregnant women, and it has that added extraordinarily important aspect of treating them to prevent infection of the baby. But many people in Arkansas who are at risk for HIV, for whatever reason, don't necessarily perceive themselves to be at risk. So what we see, unfortunately, not a lot of, but a steady amount of individuals who do have HIV but have never been tested for it, either because they don't want to know or because they just don't have access to healthcare or they're not educated enough to put their symptoms together. And so we still see a fair number of people who come to us with severe opportunistic infections because they have far advanced AIDS. And I think statewide and nationwide, one of our goals should be, just as Dr. VS had said previously, to identify, diagnose, and treat these people before they get full-blown AIDS and get sick from it. I think we need to educate people that as part of any adult's routine health care, there should be testing for HIV at least once. And if you have risk of infection, meaning more than one sexual partner or a partner who has more than one sexual partner or injection drug use, you should be tested every year.
Now, how far back should that go? Let's say, just for example, that a couple who, they got a divorce, so they remarry, but their new partner, they should be tested every year?
Well, you get the first test, and if your test is negative and your partner's test is negative, then you don't need to be tested every year. So you kind of get, clock starts when you get that first negative test. Now, if you were to then separate again and get a new partner, you should get tested again. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. The other phenomenon that we see here in Arkansas, but not just in Arkansas, it's nationwide and it's been present for a while, does tie into the whole generational thing. Young people, especially, and again, getting back to men who have sex with men, have not seen their friends, their buddies, their sexual partners dying of AIDS the way people did in the 80s. The younger people, some of them, I don't want to speak too broadly, don't know the history. Evidence suggests that they're repeating it. You know, young people, adolescents, in many ways feel invincible anyway. We're seeing, and again, I don't want to say it's 100%, but the overall thinking in young, mainly men who have sex with men, is that, you know, I've never seen anybody die from this. They have one pill, I can take it once a day, and I can live a regular life. So what the heck? And we measure that indirectly by an increase in other sexually transmitted infections. So syphilis rates go up, gonorrhea rates go up, and a lot of that transmission is male to male, and that's just a marker of high risk behavior. So I think we need to continue to get the educational message out and make sure young people know that they can get this infection. And although we have good treatments, it's still at this point incurable.
Sounds like the fear factor is gone, Dr. Villas.
To a great extent that's true, that people have not seen what people were seeing in the 80s, that in the homosexual community, we mentioned that there was a lot of activism, and there still is, but it was because people were seeing their partners and their friends dying all around them. And when it became clear how it was spread, that there were steps that people could take to protect themselves and their partners, education campaigns went out within the community. So not from some outside entity, but within the communities most at risk, these things were really brought out and championed. And that's waned somewhat. We're seeing, like Dr. Sassenti said, was that people are seeing that it is a treatable infection. And so I think that the fear to some extent has waned, and with that, the levels of protection that are necessary. And that becomes even more important if we can test the population and people that have already been infected, we can get them into care and on treatment, then they're less likely to transmit. And it's been shown whether or not a person is on treatment, if they know that they have the virus, they modify their behavior and they're less likely to transmit to somebody else. And certainly that's magnified many times if they're on therapy. I mean, that's been shown in other parts of the world, in Africa, in towns where a lot of the patients with HIV are on treatment, there are fewer new infections, even with everything else being equal. So we know that having persons on therapy has that added benefit, what we call treatment as prevention, that treating the individual patient has a public health benefit to prevent new infections. Mm-hmm. We've known since the late 80s, early 90s, that how to prevent HIV. Theoretically, we could stop all new infections with education, safer sex practices, blood donor screening, those things. Now, that's easier said than done, but effective treatment and getting persons onto effective treatment is a very powerful part of that armamentarium. And it starts with having access to care. And in Arkansas, unfortunately, that is a huge problem. And we see that in the populations that are most at risk, you know, minority populations, especially men who have sex with men, but heterosexuals as well. And especially in areas like the Delta, where access to care is more difficult to come by.
If you can put this discussion in the form of a graph, from what I'm hearing you say, especially here in the latter part of it, is that if we started at the high end in the 80s and went down in frequency because we got this thing under control and started to get things going, but now we may be moving back up again? Is that graph right?
To a degree. We count AIDS cases. The Centers for Disease Control has been counting new AIDS cases, you know, since the beginning of the epidemic. And that curve starts off, you know, relatively low, and it peaks and it starts to fall at about the time where we had the new treatments because we could prevent the development of AIDS.
Mid-90s.
It falls off and then it plateaus, and then it does start to drift up just a little bit, not nearly as high as it was before.
When does it start to drift up, roughly?
We see the peak probably in the early 90s of new infections. And then we start seeing that come down just before the new medications due to education. And then we see a very rapid fall. And then it levels out to slight increase. And that number is about 50,000 new cases of HIV in this country per year.
Is that stable?
Pretty stable year after year for at least the last decade.
It is flat at about 50,000 cases. And part of that problem is that people don't get tested for HIV. Yeah. They're not identified, and they unknowingly infect other people.
Mm-hmm. How do you get tested?
One of the problems all over the country, and not just in Arkansas, is that, say, a woman goes to a rural healthcare provider, and she'll get a flu shot, she'll get a pap smear, but they won't recommend a routine HIV test. It's somehow thought that if you offer an HIV test to a patient that you're insulting them and saying that, you know, they're promiscuous or gay. And again, the recommendation is for everyone to know their status and get tested at least once. And those are at risk get tested more often. And the people who enter into a new relationship get tested at that time and practice safer sex. But that's not done. And that's the reason that we see those 50,000 cases every year. And there hasn't been an impact on that despite the newer therapies.
So is society standing in the way of testing?
Well, it's not just society. It's also healthcare providers who are reluctant to test patients. And we sing that song to the medical students and all the doctors in training at the med center that when they go out and practice, they make that a routine part of primary care.
And that's something we all of us hear from good physicians, that I don't have any patients with HIV in my practice. I have good people that I see and they wouldn't have HIV. Well, that's not the case. This is not a disease that discriminates in that regards. And so chances are most providers probably have patients that have HIV. They just don't know it. And that's why for a number of years now, the CDC has recommended that people be tested at least once in this, you know, if they have any risk factor in the course of their routine primary care. And that's a big focus of our education, as John said, for our medical students and trainees, certainly. But even when we're giving continuing medical education to providers in practice, the health department sees new cases in almost every county. There's not a corner of this state that's not touched by this virus and has.
And what did you say was the total number in Arkansas right now? Roughly
about 8,000. total HIV cases to date.
Okay. Since the beginning of the epidemic.
And
the,
yeah, since we started counting cases.
What does that group look like generationally? Is it, are they mainly older people or are they?
We have patients that we follow at the med center that are well into their 70s. And we see some young people as early as 16 or 17 that are newly diagnosed.
That young age, how did they happen to get tested?
Unprotected sex. They might develop signs or symptoms of acute infection. They might have swollen lymph nodes, a rash, fever, sore throat, things that we might see with patients that are newly infected. And their healthcare provider might think to get an HIV test or a viral load to actually detect the virus. Other ways that they might get tested is that Arkansas is one of many states that has what's called contact tracing. So if someone tests positive for HIV, they go out and interview that person to get the names of their sexual partners, not in a police state kind of way, but they would go to the people that had been exposed by that person and say, sometime in the last 10 years, you've been exposed to HIV and you need to get a test. They don't identify that person. They don't identify where they are. They tell the person that they need to get an HIV test. We do that with syphilis. We do it with gonorrhea and with HIV as well. So that might be a way that they get tested.
And certainly anybody that presents themselves at a health department clinic with a sexually transmitted disease of any sort will get tested for HIV. Anybody with tuberculosis who, you know, comes into the care at the Arkansas Department of Health will be tested for HIV. Anybody who's pregnant will be tested for HIV. But if you're a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old and you have HIV and you're completely asymptomatic, because that's the majority of the time that you have HIV, you really are without symptoms, that person likely is not going to get tested.
That's part of the conundrum, because that young population is, you know, also, when you look at age groups, they're the most sexually active. So persons that are in their late teens, 20s, 30s, they are also the ones that are becoming infected most commonly. That we see a majority of our age group, of our new diagnoses in that age group, but the spectrum is wide. We see them from their teens all the way up into their 70s. But the CDC, their testing recommendations are from age 13 to 64 for routine screening. Mm-hmm. And that's because that's where you see the majority of that graph. And then there are outliers on both sides. But we see a fair number of older persons as well that are living with HIV. We mentioned that graph of the new infections and how it's plateaued out. There's another component to that graph where, superimposed on the number of new infections over time, what we see are the persons living with AIDS. And so during the early part of that graph, you can see as the number of HIV and AIDS cases goes up, the persons living with it are actually trending down because people are dying of their infection. It was an invariably fatal disease. With the advent of highly active antiretroviral therapy, what we see is that the number of new cases are leveled off, but the number of persons living with HIV and AIDS is steadily climbing because we have new infections that are occurring, and the persons that are becoming infected now are surviving. They're living, you know, a good quality and quantity of life. And so what we call the prevalence, the number of people that are living with this diagnosis, is steadily increasing.
John Allen, do you have any final thoughts about AIDS and what you'd like to get across to our audience?
One of the things that we didn't mention was access to care. And there's what's called a pyramid of care in that 90% of the people that actually have HIV are diagnosed with the disease. And then a smaller portion of those, about 60%, have actually seen a doctor for their HIV infection. 30% of those, about a third, have gotten onto antiretroviral therapy. And a smaller percentage are successfully taking that every day and have an undetectable viral load. So we're doing a very poor job nationally and also in Arkansas in getting people into care, getting them on effective treatment. We really need to work on that. And that's particularly a problem in rural areas of Arkansas where there is no HIV expert to treat them, and the pharmacies don't carry the medications, and there's a real stigma about the disease. And, you know, we are in the Bible Belt, where if you have HIV, you're not a good person, and you've you've gotten the disease because you've done something wrong and you've sinned. Mm-hmm. And that drives people into not getting care, not going to the doctor, not going to the pharmacy and getting their medication filled. And there's a lot of difficulty in them driving 3 hours to get to Little Rock to see an HIV expert, because that's where most of the bulk of the people are that treat HIV.
Dr. Sissendi, final thoughts?
I will just tell you that from my perspective as a physician who treats people with HIV and was able to see the transition from semi-effective, ultimately ineffective therapy all the way to where we are today, there is nothing more satisfying than seeing my patients come into clinic and doing well with their infection. Since I've been here in Little Rock for 17 years, I have patients that I've followed with HIV that entire time. They have seen their children grow up. They have maintained their employment. They have celebrated anniversaries. And it's just been very satisfying from my perspective as a physician to see that change from a invariably fatal disease that we can do not much about to, hey, you know, you can see your kids graduate and you can live essentially a normal lifespan. There's nothing more gratifying in my practice than seeing that.
Dr. Villas?
I think similar to that, being able to tell, you know, I have patients that now one of the ways that they're diagnosed, especially the young people, is, you know, colleges have screening fairs and you can come and get screened. We've had people that have been diagnosed that way. And talking to those patients, you know, they're understandably very frightened. I think that the big message is that there are reasons to celebrate where we are now when it comes to being able to treat the HIV patient and allowing them great quality and quantity of life. But there's also a lot of hope when you have somebody young like that. What we can tell them in this day and age is that you are not going to die from this infection, that we have good medicines, that you can get married. Your partner does not have to get this infection from you. You can have children, and your children don't have to be infected when this is a great time. And even more than that, there's a lot of hope going forward, not just for new and novel treatments, although that is certainly the case, but also for other things, for more awareness of providers to be able to care for patients who persons with HIV in their communities and to do it in an effective manner. One of the things that we're doing is seeing patients via telemedicine in their doctor's office so that they don't have to drive 3 hours to come to Little Rock, that they can be in their hometown and receive good quality care for their disease. Hope for having more access to care with the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion, hopefully if it continues in this state, many of our patients that are at the highest risk will be able to get into care. What we know is that it's certainly over the long run cheaper to treat patients, to allow them a great quality of life, to allow them to be productive members of society, than to save the money on the medications. When they get sick, it's much more expensive to have them end up in the hospital. And so I think with expanded access, with expanded understanding, expanded treatments, we haven't peaked yet with HIV care. There's reason to be optimistic going forward.
Folks, if you've been listening to the program tonight, I do want to invite you, if you'd like to listen to the longer version, you can go to KUAR.org, click on the programs button there. You'll be able to listen to both the first and the second portions of our program here on AIDS. I do want to thank my guests for being with me here today. We've had a really terrific discussion, and I'm glad that we can break it down and give you two programs on this topic about AIDS. Speaking from the older generation has been John Allen. He's a special consultant for HIV and AIDS here at UAMS. John Allen, thanks so much for bringing your perspectives here today.
Pleasure to be here.
And then speaking from the middle generation perspective has been Dr. Michael Sissendi here at UAMS. Dr. Sissendi, thanks so much for being here today.
You're very welcome.
And then also from the younger generation perspective has been Dr. Heyer Villas, assistant professor in the Department of Infectious Disease here at UAMS. All three, Dr. Villas, thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much.
It's really been a great discussion. I've gotten a lot out of it, and I hope you too as you've been listening. Join us again next week. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you then. This has been part one of our program on AIDS here on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Next week, we'll have part two.